Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour on August 18th, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager. As you can probably hear, we're having a rainstorm here, and it started earlier, and we had a real nice downpour, and it's quieted down, and then it just started again when the program, as this program started. So, with my very good mic that picks up so much, although I do have that muffler thing on it, so I don't know how it sounds to you, but it just got a little bit lighter right now. It'll probably be coming on and off, and you might hear some thunder and so on. If it gets really loud, I would appreciate it if one of my regular listeners who tends to email me at carolynyeager.net, Carolyn at CarolynYeager.net will maybe send me a little message. I've got my email page up, although I'm not looking at it, but I tend to forget to look at it. But I will try to check it out after 5-10 minutes or so. It's not too bad right now, and I've done programs with it really with hail coming down and making a huge racket. So I'm sure we can all deal with this. So I will say that tonight it's back to the Holohoax with David Cole battling the majority of revisionists over what occurred in the East and how to make sure that Jews were gassed after all. It's like there has to be, with certain of these people who call themselves revisionists, they are, but they're a little bit different than some of the others, seem to insist that there have to be a lot of Jew deaths, and since they've already determined that they didn't happen at Auschwitz or in any camps in Germany, then what's left is in the East and in these so-called little transit camps, or maybe other ways. So, in order to put this to rest in my own mind, I thought I would visit it one more time because Cole has just written and posted another article about it. It is on his blog. Let's see. Let me scroll down a little bit. It's on his blog at what it's called. What happened to it? Nope. Where is it? Here. I was looking for red. It's www.countercontempt.com. It's countercontempt, countercontempt.com. You know, it's interesting that he would select a name like that, contempt. I mean, he is showing so much contempt for so many people. I didn't pay a lot of attention to the name of that. His site is called something else, like, I don't know. I'd have to look at it. Okay, I'm going to go there. Since the rain has stopped, where is it? Now I got to find it again. Here it is. All right. Sorry about this bad opening here. Here comes some thunder, though. Big Infidel. I'm really not trying to advertise him. But his site is called Big Infidel, and this post is called Cole Again on Treblinka and the Reinhardt Camps, posted on August 12, 2014. That was 6 days ago. So to get back to my own story here, I was saying that... I want to say is I don't want to be boring all of you, because I've talked about this before. But I just keep having the feeling that there's something missing, something I don't yet understand, which is not odd, because I'm not an expert on this very complicated business of the Reinhardt camps. And you know, the thing is, it's not complicated, but it seems like it is. And I just never feel like I've grasped it, because Well, for one thing, there's so much that's unknown, so it's not fully understood, or the story hasn't been put together in a way that I'd say, well, this is the story, because, you know, most of it is a lot of speculation. And then so much of it, of what's important in this story is in German, particularly that Chorherr document. And it all revolves around this Chorherr document. And I can't actually read these reports in the original German. And you don't see it. I don't know that I've ever seen the whole thing translated, unless maybe it's not that long, and I have. But I get a little bored when I just see things like this with all these numbers and so on. And so while I will have read it, I will also forget it quickly. Because other things are in my mind, and that just doesn't hold very well. So then I depend on what others are saying and telling about it, and then I think, well, gee, I'm just not, you know, I don't really know enough. I don't know enough about it. So this time I carefully read Cole's new entry that I just told you about, and all the comments that have been written after it, too. And I wanted to know exactly what he meant when saying that Robert Forey's song was dishonest. I thought that was a pretty strong statement. It didn't fit my impression of Forey's song. So I was glad that he added in this article what he had written in 1995. As he calls it, his answer to what Forey's song wrote about him in 1994. See, so this goes way back. This goes back to the mid-90s, and it's still these hard feelings about it. The fact is that what Forey's song, and this will come up in just a little bit, but what Forey's song wrote about Cole was in kind of in conjunction with things he wrote about those camps. What he wrote was just in a few emails that he sent out, and he resent these emails after Cole's book came out, and Cole was saying some things about Forey's song that weren't very nice, and so Forison sent these out, and I got hold of them, and I posted them right away on my website, carolynyeager.net. And later, just not, a couple weeks ago maybe, that might have been one of the first things he posted. Then anyway, Bradley Smith posted them, and I don't know if some other people have, So then now, I guess that Cole was looking for his response that he wrote in 1995 to Forey's song, and he finally found it at NiceCore. So we'll get into that in a minute. So I read all that. I read the NiceCore thing, which was quite long, And I'm better able now to judge this whole business. I really tried to pay attention and get it clear. And it's not, you know, it all sounds more complicated than it is, because they make it out to be complicated, because they're arguing. And Cole makes it out to be, well, if you try to read Cole, you'll think, oh, wow, I just don't know, because he puts the story, in my opinion, as the way that makes him look best. I don't think that he tries real hard to be exact, to tell the whole story as much as he tries to tell his own side of it. But then you can say that about everybody involved, if you want to. So let's just see what's going on with this. And I hope this will really be the last time I have to talk about it, or I feel like I want to talk about it, and I feel like I've, you know, it's clear enough, although there's still more to be said about it. However, did I say this? After carefully reading all of it, I feel better able to judge it, and my conclusion is, my temporary conclusion, is that it's not as big a deal as they make it out to be, or as he makes it out to be, really as Cole makes it out to be, as that he's got all kinds of proof of something. So it's basically about how do we account for this large number of Jews that's mentioned in a report requested by Himmler called the Korher Report, because it was written by a statistician named Richard Korher. I think it was Richard. I'm pretty sure. Because it's not clear where all these Jews went or what fate befell them. The Holocausters decided to say they were all gassed in special gas chambers built in three small camps in the East. These gas chambers were built in these small camps that were built in the East just, you know, in 1941, 1942. And these are close to the old Soviet border, what I call the old Soviet border, because this area beyond it was now occupied territory, occupied by the Germans who were pushing the front further east. And the camps were named Belzec, Treblinka, Sobibor, along with Chelmno, Chelmno, which I don't know exactly if that was older or what, but so that's it. That's a Holocauster story, all right. They insist there are all these Jews unaccounted for, and that the only way to account for them is to say that they were murdered, and they decided way back when that they were murdered in these camps in gas chambers. So that's there historiography. It's all set in stone, so to speak, and that's what they say at all those camps, and that's what they say in the literature. So now it's supposed to be vitally important that revisionists account for these. What they say now are 2.4 million Jews. That's what the Korher report shows. I mean, if it was just the so-called witnesses and the stories that came out that there were gas chambers here and people were being gassed, it wouldn't carry much weight at all. But this Korher report was discovered, and everyone seems to agree that it's authentic, then it says that there were 2.4 million Jews who were transferred east, who were transferred, and they ended up. This is not real clear, but supposedly they ended up being sent to these. To these little camps, and then what happened to them must have been that they were killed there in gas chambers, because that's their favorite way to kill Jews, is in gas chambers, as the story goes. But the fact is that they don't account for gas chambers. They're not able to really account for these gas chambers in these camps or for the remains of all those people gassed, but that never seemed to matter to them. Of course, then the revisionists brought all that up. Now the argument is that a few revisionists, amounts mostly to David Irving and then Mark Weber and then David Cole, have taken it up that first Irving and the others followed along pretty much, that it has to be that these Jews were were gassed in these camps or were killed in these camps. Now, this is the part that keeps changing. They're not sure. They were murdered, but how? How? Except that the official Holocaust story is that they were gassed. And it was over 2 million of them, 2 million or more. And this is because of the Corhair report. David Irving started saying this when he learned about the Corhair report. He says, well, this is the proof. And he's stuck with that story ever since. And he's supposed to be writing a book about it. And this has been like 5 years or so. He's writing this book, and it's supposed to be connected with his book on Himmler, showing how Himmler was behind the whole extermination program and not Hitler. And Himmler did it on his own, and stuff like that is what we hear. But the book is supposed to come out in 2015, early. But nobody's holding their breath on that because he's promised it. He's been promising it all along and hasn't come up with it. So this is, I know this is not news to most of you listening, probably, but there will be some people who might appreciate having it sorted out from the beginning, you know, to see what is the issue here anyway, because otherwise it can just go over your head and you say, that's too complicated or too hard to understand. Well, it really isn't. So now here we have this, here's where it stands, you know, what happened to these Jews? What happened to these Jews? We have to know, because if they were gassed or if they were murdered in that number, over 2 million, then there was a Holocaust for sure. But if they weren't, then the revisionists say there was no Holocaust. There was just some actions and so on, and anti-Jewish and feelings and removal of Jews from European and German occupied territory and so on, but not a plan to exterminate Jews and actually, as the story has been in its full form, kill every Jew on the face of the earth if they could. Their long-range plan, these Nazis, was to exterminate Jews down to the last one. And they were, when they saw they were losing the war, they started hurrying up their extermination program and doing it in the East. So this is, now I'm starting to think that, something I've heard other people say who aren't really revisionists and just don't like Jews and don't think, see the problem with Jews clearly and don't want to have to get into all this revisionist stuff. And they say, for them, who cares what happened to the Jews? It's good if the Jews, as many Jews are gone, it's a good thing. And, you know, I'm not going to be liked by revisionists for saying this, but I'm starting to think the same way. I mean, this becomes, why do we have to care so much what happened to them? People all over the place, I mean, I shouldn't say all over the place, but people in many countries, in many situations, have disappeared for one reason or another and have been mass murdered. Of course, over 2 million is a very large number, but we don't have any proof that it's that number. Look at 15 million Germans were killed in World War II, and that's not a lot of them civilians. There might have been 15 million civilians. I didn't check those numbers out. But nobody's worried about blaming who's responsible for that, who killed every last one of those people, who did it. It's a state of war, so it's okay. They have all kinds of excuses for it. Whereas the state of war here, too, and it can be shown that the Jews were the enemies of the German Reich and of Hitler's war and so on. And so, therefore, the fact that moderates the fact that they would be put to death, that they would be killed. But no, somehow, with when it comes to this and to Jews, well, the whole story has to be painted out exactly, and you have to defend yourself for harming any hair on every last Jew. You have to, well, I might be exaggerating there, but you do have to defend yourself about the Jews, whereas nobody has to defend themselves about killing Germans. They don't do it. They're accused of it often enough, but they just ignore it, and they get away with it, too, because they rule the world. Well, so there's that. So I'll say that what's at the base of so many of these Holocaust myth problems is the false idea, and I say it's utterly false when placed against natural law and nature, that every life is precious and irreplaceable and has high value. Now, I grew up with this, and most of you probably did, and some of you may still believe this, because this is taught to us everywhere, and it was supposed to be taken for granted, and it sounds good, and we wouldn't want people not to put any value on our life, so we should, you know, make sure that we value other people's lives too. But you know, in real terms, no high value has been assigned by nature on anybody, on any particular individual. This is something that we do. This is one of our cultural beliefs, you might say, and religious too, that God knows the hair on every hair on everybody's head and cares about everyone, even the smallest sparrow and so on. And so that, you know, we're told that we must do everything in our power to protect every last individual life that we're able to do. Natural disasters and contagious diseases wipe out large populations indiscriminately. And this doesn't happen so much, anymore because we have so much better communication and ways of knowing weather prediction and so on, and ways of avoiding deaths, but the damage occurs nevertheless. And so now, because we take care of everybody, we have overpopulation from this. Our problem is too great a population for our planet and for the areas that most people want to live in. You know, the nicer areas get more and more crowded. That at one time, these things kind of cleared away a lot of the population, and things would start over again. And it was not very nice, but that's the way nature does it, because nature wants to keep a balance. The intent of nature is to keep life going, that's it, period, because there's always new life. And there's always new, not only people, but animals and plants and so on being born or being seeded, what have you. I mean, it doesn't, the whole purpose is to keep life going. It has its way of doing that. And it's more important to maintain the balance of life so that life can continue. So therefore, harmful events like hurricanes, tornadoes, volcanic eruptions, everything from droughts to deluges to flooding to crop destruction, etc., are tolerated, have been tolerated in the course by nature, because all these things are part of keeping, part of keeping the balance of life going. And if hundreds or thousands are even millions of people perish instantaneously As might have, they weren't that many people in the past, I guess, so there wouldn't have been that kind of numbers. But if they perish, well, so be it. You know, life will continue and new things will come up and we'll grow up. Well, this is what Hitler came to realize. And there's just a lot of wisdom there. And I'm attracted to it more and more all the time. Of course, I guess as I get older, my life doesn't have the high value to it, even than it used to when I was in my 20s and 30s, and I had a lot of life to live. So I, you know, might have had trouble. And this never occurred to me at that time. But anyway, at my now wise position, I can see the wisdom of it. So I already talked about why Germans are expected to follow stricter moral guidelines than others. But, for example, we had the British blockades starving the Germans after World War I and post-World War II camps and policies against the Germans did the same thing. And I gave some of the numbers were in the millions. You know, I don't know about the British blockade numbers, but they didn't mind starving Germans. And children were the greatest casualty from that. But even though it's not looked upon, it's looked upon as wrong, it's not, no big deal is made out of it. And then Jews took over Russia. International jewelry, in a sense, that's basically where it came from, created a Soviet state and murdered millions upon millions. And then they wanted to do the same thing in Germany. So if Jews were trying to kill Germans, why shouldn't Germans be able to kill them back? That's what I say. And I'm very serious about that. You might think it sounds simplistic, and some people would say, oh, but no, it makes sense to me. It's just put on some people are to be made guilty for what they do, and other people are not guilty for it. Jews are not guilty for wanting to destroy Germans in Germany. They're not seen that way. They're still seen as victims all the time. Even though they were doing this. And so I think that fighting back under whatever, you know, with strong measures is all right. And from my, well, I'll wait till I get to some of this. Okay. My last point I'll make here is that Jews are the noxious weeds of the planet. For those who think that, and there are a lot of people who believe this and understand this, okay, that Jews are the noxious weeds of the planet. And what do you do with noxious weeds? So, you know, Jews should be destroyed or kept under control. This is the logical conclusion of that. But then we're not supposed to go there. I mean, that sounds horrible to people. Oh, that's terrible. And I understand, you know, I'm probably saying too much, but I get tired of sometimes, you know, I just have to say what I think. I want to point out the contradiction in people who will agree that Jews are a danger in the world, that Jews are a big problem in the world, more than a problem. They're an infection, and they're also called what's that word? I can't think of it. Oh, anyway, they live off others, and in living off others, they destroy those that they live off. And yet, when it comes to harming a Jew, people just shudder. It's, oh, no, I'm not advocating that. Well, what are they advocating? What are you going to do with them? How do you keep it? How do you keep the Jewish problem under control? Well, okay. Now we go to David Cole, who is a Jew, and he was a very popular Jew in his first incarnation as a revisionist. And then he disappeared, you know. And he's come back, and when he came back, everybody, he didn't come back voluntarily. He was forced out of his secret life, where David Cole was suppressed, and he became David Stein. Had a totally different life, but he got forced out of that, outed, as he says. And so then all the revisionists were like, oh, wow, David Cole's back. Oh, welcome back, David. Well, did you suffer real badly? He wasn't suffering at all. We're just so glad to see you. I hope, you know, they weren't sure he would do any revisionist work, but they certainly thought, well, maybe he will, and thought that would just be great. Well, I guess the first thing he did was get chummy with Mark Webber, and then I don't really know how it went. He was just getting a lot of publicity and using it, and then I guess he started working on writing a book so that he could, because he needed money, because he was used to earning money. It wasn't too difficult for him, and so. He started talking about revisionism, but wasn't the way that people wanted to hear it. And he became a kind of an anti-revisionist. And now he's in his latest article, he's full out anti-revisionist. He attacks revisionists. And it happens step by step. But he sort of, it seems to me he set it up, because he's a very acerbic, caustic Jew, a Jew, you know, which Jews are already. He appears to be quite the put down artist now, which he didn't appear to be in his earlier incarnation. And he's just a typical, he's stereotypically Jewish now. Of course, what he was doing in these intervening years, he was drinking a lot. He calls himself an alcoholic. So he, brought this out in him, brought the worst out of him. Alcoholism brings that out. So now he's not the same David Cole as he was back then, although that David Cole existed in ways that we didn't recognize, or people didn't recognize, because he kind of kept it hidden. He says, I never denied anything. I said a lot of things. Yeah, I remember on one of those television shows, I remember him being asked, and he said that, no, he didn't deny the Holocaust. He didn't deny that Jews were murdered. He didn't this and that. And I thought, oh, really? But at the time, I don't remember that, but looking at it afterwards, I saw that. That was before he came back. And I thought, well, really, but he didn't go into it. So because we just have this picture of him as strongly proving that there was no gassings at Auschwitz, we just think that he's on board all the way, and we just pass these things by, and really we see him as, well, he has to say that. He has to say that, both because he's a Jew and because, you know, you can't appear to be cold-hearted about it, and you can't appear to be too extreme. So, you know, we assumed a lot of things about that, and gave him a lot of leeway. And then this alcoholism plays a big part, because I'm quite familiar with the alcoholic traits and alcoholic people and so on. And, you know, alcoholics have attractive personalities, and they make good impressions. And they're very often attractive people. Of course, there's the other kind. There's a real brutish kind of not attractive kind of person who might become an alcoholic, but I mean that typical successful person who could be successful, who has a lot of brains and charm, and yet does have this alcoholism problem, which I do think is inherited in many, many cases. And so this alcoholic person works hard to begin with. When they get into a new venture, meet new people, they'll work hard, and once they're accepted, though, they start sloughing off. And they're programmed to eventually screw up. I mean, usually they work hard and do such brilliant and good things that the people around them just all go gaga over them, you know, just love them and just tell them, oh, you know, you're doing great, you know, thank you. And they promote them if it's a job or they do this or that and give them a raise or whatever. And then he says, well, now I'm kind of in like Flynn here. And then the seeds of destruction that are in an alcoholic start to sprout. And it's just amazing how the alcoholic personality will always screw up in the end, even in the best of circumstances. He can have the best job, best people around him, and he will screw it up. In alcoholism, and this is in any kind of addiction, the person tends to see themselves as either too good, better than those around them, or not good enough, and that the people around them see them in that way, that the people around them are finding fault with them and don't think well of them. And they're not able to stay in that middle place where, you know, they're good but not overly good, or they're not overly bad, they're okay. They're not able to be in that place. It's either they go from one extreme to the other, and then naturally they imagine other people see them the same way. And they eventually will quit what they're doing, or they're kicked out, or they're fired or whatever. Then they look for a new group of people and make a fresh start until their alcoholism has gone so far that they can't make any more fresh starts. But with David Cole, you can see that he seems unable to control himself from making enemies among these people who were friends with him, or maybe they weren't all friends. One who was certainly friends with him was Bradley Smith. But he seems to be unable to keep from striking out against these people now. And he said that when he was writing his book, he was drunk. He was drinking the whole, I guess, what did he say? He spent 4 or 5 months writing his book and while he was drinking. He's got a pretty bad case of drinking, I would say. Now, going to his article about that's on his blog that I mentioned, Cole Again on Treblinka and the Reinhardt Camps, posted on August 12th. I'm going to go through this. It's pretty long, but I can go through it. Somewhere down further along, I'm going to, you know, kind of skim over some of it because it gets kind of tedious, but and I have some commentary to make, and I think that it's instructive. It was instructive to me, and this program today is for people who are interested in revisionism. If you're not, you're not going to be too interested in this. But I'm going to do this because I think what Cole is doing and what he's bringing to revisionism today, and which takes in this this problem of the Reinhardt camps, which is kind of the main focus of revisionism now too, unresolved things, is important for us to understand. And so he writes, ever since posting via my publisher my expanded views regarding Treblinka and the Reinhardt camps, I have been accused of attacking other revisionists, and I have been told that my position is a result of A, JDL threats, B, a payoff from the Jews, C, my alcoholism, D, my grief over my mother's health, E, my neocon beliefs, and F, all of the above. Well, I want to say I don't attribute it to any of those things, but to the fact that he is a Jew. That's what I attribute it to. And very Jewy Jew, as I've already said. He's not a Jew who is at odds with his own people, as so many wanted to assume during his pre-disappearance days. I did. I thought, well, a guy like David Cole, and I thought a lot of him, I liked him. He came across as a really nice personality and a smart guy and just in every good way on those TV programs. Although I do recall that on one of them, one of those panel show things where he was there with Bradley Smith, he seemed to hang around better when he was with Mark Weber. And one of them, they were all three there, I think. But this one, he was with, I think it was just he and Bradley Smith. And it couldn't have been more than 15, 20 minutes into the 2-hour program or something, however long it was. And he got so angry. He got so disgusted. And you can understand why. He got frustrated pretty early. And he got up and walked out. And Bradley was left there, sitting there. He didn't show any emotion whatsoever, Bradley. But Bradley was left there the whole rest of the show to take all that abuse by himself. And now that I think about that now, I thought, well, poor David Cole, he couldn't handle it. At least maybe Bradley should have got up and walked out too, because, they weren't treating them right. And Cole had the nerve to get up and walk out. But, that's possible, but it showed that he couldn't handle his frustration, and so he just walked away. That's kind of fits with what I was talking about before. But in any case, I assumed that he couldn't be a real Jew, but it turns out he is a real Jew, and he says he always was, and it appears that he was then too. He claims that he never said or implied that he wasn't, and I suppose he didn't. So he goes on to say, I appreciate that some of you feel as though you know my life better than I do, but if I can momentarily be qualified by you eminent experts as an authoritative source on my own life, I will state that A, the JDL has made no attempt to contact me since I resurfaced, something that I'm very pleased about, and B, I can't even get dicks like Larry Elder to pay me for work I did before my outing. Hell, I wish a few Jews, spelled J-O-O-S, would offer me a check these days, but no dice. See, now this is typical smart aleck Jew talk, smart Jew talk, and also, I guess, smart Southern California Hollywood-style talk or something. But he uses the word dick for this Larry Elder. I mean, he doesn't have to talk like that, but he does. And Larry Elder is a milk chocolate-colored Negro radio talk show host in the South who, I guess, is pretty popular. He's got like a 3-hour afternoon show on AM radio, and has a lot of listeners. And then he uses the word and just the attitude, I thought, of saying attacking everybody out there, everybody who's reading this. You feel as though you know my life better than I do, but if I might just say, if I might just be qualified to, by you, eminent expert, see, that's a put-down, as an authoritative source on my own life, I will say now, here he becomes the center of attention. He is, you know, everybody cares about him. Everybody's eyes are on him. And he's going to tell you what's what. And I think this is another thing that is Jewy, that he wants to be, he thinks he belongs in the center of everything, in the center of attention. And he thought that as a revisionist, he was the best and he was the leader and he should be seen as the leader and attention should be put on him. And whenever it's not, he does something to bring it back to him, or he says, I don't want anything more to do with you people. But he goes on to say that another, again, that since he, that his alcoholism makes him irritable but not stupid. So what is he talking about here? He said I lost track of where this started. To be an authoritative source on his own life, he's saying that what he's doing is not because of his alcoholism. Once again, it's not because of his mother's health. That none of that has made him dim and stupid. He's talking about people thinking that he's stupid because of what he's doing now in revisionism. That's what it's about. He's saying, you know, I'm not stupid. I'm not saying these things because I have all these problems and they're influencing my thinking. And I'm not saying them because my political beliefs, because they have no bearing on my history work, on his work as a historian, revisionist historian, he says, his political beliefs. Well, he brings up that he's anti-Nazi enough times that I would kind of question that. But anyway, he says, if I make a historical claim, I back it up with facts and documents. Where I stand on abortion or Obama or legalized pot or school vouchers, blah, blah. It doesn't make any difference. It's irrelevant. Because, he says, I either make my case for my historical claims based on facts and documents, or I fail. Now, this all kind of sounds to me like he's got a chip on his shoulder, kind of adolescent-like. Like, you know, don't try to tell me who I am and what I am. I'm telling you what I am, and this is what I am, and I'm the real thing, and I use facts and documents. And if I don't have that, then I don't make my case. And then he says, two small observations. Number one, what transpired recently with Bradley Smith and Faurisson through his proxy Leuchter, maybe that's some people pronounce it Leuchter, is not new. New to you, maybe, but that doesn't mean it's new. Back in 1994, the exact same thing happened. Excuse me. Faurisson attacked me with personal insults. Now, he's going back to 94. And those, I think those emails, I should probably get those. I'm not going to read those emails, though, but you should be able to find them. He criticized... He criticized Cole a little bit for what was it now? For his, for his comments about gas chambers, I think, or gassing or something like that. And, whatever words he used, Cole thought it was, he took it as a personal insult. And then he accused Faurisson as using Henri Roch as a proxy. Henri Roch is was just who went along with was present during some adventure of Cole's, and then he says, in 1994, then, after that, I got angry at Smith for acting like a scared little lackey of Forison's, a scared little lackey. And Smith responded by sending my personal correspondences, faxes at that time, to dozens of other revisionists. Well, you know, to say that because Fred Leuchter wrote on his Facebook page or on David Cole's Facebook page or whatever, defending David's attacks on Forison, means that Leuchter is Forison's proxy. You see, that's silly. That's silly. Leuchter respects Forison, and they did some travels and work together, which David Cole was involved in too, some of it, and so he's not going to stand by while Forison gets attacked by Cole. But Cole sees it as his proxy. And then back in 1994, this Henri Roque was cannot be said to have been Forison's proxy, just because they were both French. But Cole is making that accusation. And then from that, he says that Smith was acting like a scared little lackey of Forison's. There's another insult because Smith did not want to go along with Cole in attacking Forison, who he's known for longer than he's known Cole and has a lot of respect for. But Cole, thought that Smith should be on his side, on Cole's side, I guess, and therefore called him a lackey of Forison. See, this kind of wild talk and accusations on about personal things like this says a lot about Cole and is turning everybody off. So, and then when he says that Smith sent out his personal correspondence to dozens of other revisionists. Well, I don't know how many, but are there dozens of revisionists that he would be sending this to? Maybe he has a list of a lot of people interested in revisionism, yeah, and he sent it there. Smith is like Tobin. He shares everything for the most part, and he sends things to people. He thinks that all this stuff, it's good to air all this stuff and work it out. But Cole felt that Smith should be loyal to him and be on his side because they were friends and ignore all the others, I guess. So the only difference, Cole writes, the only difference this time is that Forison has a new proxy, Leuchter, and Smith now has the only difference between 1994 and 2014, he means, Forison has a new proxy, Leuchter, and Smith has social media to send around his emails. Okay. He says, now here's what got me. Cole writes, regarding Forison, I tackled his poor historiography in a very lengthy piece I wrote in 1995. As Forison ceased to create new or relevant work decades ago, I can add nothing to what I wrote back then. See, there's another put down. Forison ceased to create relevant work in 1995, and so there's nothing more. What he wrote in 1995 is still the sum total of what he has to say about Forison. And then he turns to poor Smith again, who hasn't done anything to him, and says, and Smith, I'm not automatically against publishing private correspondences. I did it to Michael Shermer in my book. That's worse than sending it to other revisionists to put it in a book, in my opinion. But he says, but I published them in full, and with a detailed explanation of why they were relevant to Holocaust history beyond my personal belief. So, therefore, Smith somehow didn't publish them in full and didn't give a detailed explanation of why they were relevant to Holocaust history. Well, you know, if he sent them out to revisionists, they know why they're relevant. He doesn't have to explain that. So this is an example of the way, and we find a lot of these. Small, it doesn't mean much, but, you know, there it is. It's an example of the way that Cole can take anything, and he can add to it and kind of twist it around and turn it into an accusation against somebody when they're really, he really, only thing he could say would be, Smith sent out my course, our correspondence to others, because this correspondence was about Forison, I guess, and he's so angry about that he tries to make it into as much and as big of a thing as he can, and makes Smith so wrong in doing so, because he goes on to say Smith publishes private emails because he confuses airing dirty laundry with open debate. Mainly it's because he's too lazy, too old, and ill to come up with any actual new material. There's just more example of how he can, you know, add more insults. You know, this they were such friends for so long, and suddenly, you know, he just turns like this, and he just can't say enough insulting things. Too lazy, old, and ill. Not very nice to come up with anything new. So both Forison and Smith have nothing new to say. They're all used up. And then again he repeats how he published his private correspondence as though. And then he says, and when I attempted to add context to what he had published. To what Smith had published, Cole says, Smith accused me of trying to exploit my dying mother to help me win the sympathy of the reader. Now, I have my doubts whether Smith said that to him, because it doesn't sound like Smith. And he, in another place, has made a clear cut, said clearly that Smith said something to him, and he put it in quote marks, and in the comments, Smith wrote that he never said such a thing. So probably Smith, that was more important to Smith than this one. Probably Smith didn't say this either, or say it in this way, but Cole is not above putting it, even in quotes, in a way differently than what Smith would have said. I doubt he would have said that. So and then he goes on, because he's speaking about what Smith said. He's quoting Smith. His next words are, "No, asshole. I was attempting to give context to private emails that you chose to publish in an edited form." There he is, pushing on it again. So he's calling Bradley an asshole in this post he's put on his website. Publicly, you know, that's pretty strong. That's very strong. And you just have to think this, maybe he's drinking while he's writing this, you see. And once he does it and he sees that what he's done, he might just say, oh, hell with it. You know, I can't change it now. He likes to attack other people for changing what they've written. He's a big thing against Forison, we're going to find, is that Forison changed a word, of course it was an important word, but changed something in something that he had written to give it a different meaning to fit something. And that's the most serious thing he has against Forison, in my opinion. And I have to say that's he's got a point there. But therefore, he's not going to change any of the things that he does. And he doesn't seem to mind being rude, like all get out to people. I know I've been accused of being rude, but I can't say that I'm in the same category as David Cole, and I think that's Jewish, along with his alcoholism. I think that's That's one of the worst things I've seen. But the worst he's done is to Eric Hunt. But then Eric Hunt and he were never friends, and he and Bradley were friends I guess 20 years or something like that. He was bragging, Cole was bragging not too long ago when he was so angry at everybody else, but not at Bradley Smith yet. And he says, well, Bradley Smith is he's one of the only good revisionists, he and Mark Weber and David Irving and Bradley Smith. Bradley and I have been friends for 20 years, and he's a good guy. Well, and then suddenly, as soon as Bradley didn't stand up for him the way he wanted him to, and to be 100% on his side against everybody else, he goes after Bradley immediately. This isn't the first time. There was something that came up before this that he attacked Bradley. I guess in some private correspondence of theirs that Bradley published. Yeah, that was the first, and now he's done it here. So he's now done. He says that Bradley would post my private emails and then accuse me of exploiting my dying mother is beyond vile. It's probably the worst thing anyone has ever done to me. I will never forgive him. What a statement. He will never forgive Bradley for this. Now, that's it, Bradley. And but it's the worst thing anyone has ever done to him. The worst thing. I thought that what the JDL was the worst thing, but no, I guess they didn't really do that much to him. And this, because he doesn't attack them. He doesn't get angry at them. He understands them, I guess. And here's a good place to bring up, which I didn't do in a previous program that I thought I would do. But since then, Fred Tobin has brought it up. We have pictures. We have those pictures of Forisong with his bloodied face, and we know what they did to him. We don't have any pictures of David Cole. When he says he got beat up so badly and he had a tooth knocked out, he says two or three times he got beat up by these Jewish thugs. Why didn't he have a picture taken of himself afterwards? But we don't know. So there's no proof that he actually ever was beat up. I have no interest in accusing him of lying about that or doubting it or anything. It's not that important, but it is a fact that he says so, but there's no evidence of it. And since he's such a careful researcher and careful producer of evidence for things, you'd think that maybe he would have considered having someone take a picture of him afterwards just to keep for himself at that time, just to have on file of what he suffered under the hands of these JDL thugs. I'm not so sure. Therefore, we don't know for sure if it happened. Just like what happened to these Jews, these murdered Jews in the east of the Russian wilderness. Also, so going on here, also he says, Smith recently dredged up and posted Forisong's 94 attacks against me without linking to my response from 95. That's Bradley's open debate for you. And he links to on Bradley's blog where he posted those three emails from Forisong. Well, you know, the fact is that here's another instance where he's not telling the truth. He's putting it in a way that suits him, not the way it actually happened, because Smith did not dredge up these emails. Forisong sent these emails out himself, and they were sent out then through a reporter notebook, Michael Santomaro. And he has a very big mailing list, so everybody got them. And I told you, I posted them on my website as soon as I posted Yeah, I posted them on my website. Oh, I think I did. Or I linked to them or something. I quote, maybe I'm thinking of this article he wrote that I posted. Anyway, Bradley finally posted them. And but he didn't go hunting for them. He didn't dredge them up. See, why does he put it that way? Cole has to know that where they came from and that they were sent out. And then Cole himself thanks not NISCOR or NISCOR, that pro-Holocaust site, the NISCOR project, or NISCOR, for archiving his 16-page letter he wrote in response to Forey's son back in 1995. See, Smith didn't have that letter. He didn't keep it. I assume he didn't. And it was from 20 years before. So he's blaming Smith for not publishing his 1995 response. But he himself had to find it on the NISCOR website. He didn't have it either. That and he says that he thanks God for NISCOR for preserving this thing that he wrote in 1995, because nobody else had it, obviously. So the NISCOR had gotten it, and they had archived it somehow, and so he found it on there. So why would Bradley Smith have it, and why would Bradley Smith remember it? But Forey-san had just then sent out these old emails of his. And they were just emails. They weren't some big article he wrote. And so they're right there. Cole is misrepresenting the whole thing and trying to make Smith look like he was acting like an enemy to Cole. Now he quotes from this 95 article of his, but I also have some I took some things out of that 95 article, which I'm going to go into later if I have time. This is another time where I'm running out of time. I'm not covering as much as I need to get done with all this. So I have to think. I hate to leave too much out. I don't know whether to read this. I guess I will, because this is what he took, what David Cole took from his 95 article that you can find on NISCOR. I'll put the link in the program post. He takes three paragraphs and quotes from three paragraphs from that article, and they are, as an example, I'll point specifically to Forey-san's response to David Irving's Journal of Historical Review essay conference speech on the Goebbels diary appearing in the letters section of the current Journal of Historical Review, March-April 95. So he's writing this in 95. Forey-san quotes from the March 27, 1942 Goebbels diary entry and then writes, quote, in itself, this last sentence, broadly speaking, one can probably, the last sentence of Goebbels is, Goebbels writes in the diary, broadly speaking, one can probably say that 60% of them will have to be liquidated, while only 40% can be put to work. Forey-san says, tends to show that the Reich Minister of Propaganda, Goebbels, did not know for sure that there was a German policy to physically exterminate the Jews, This sentence shows that Goebbels did not know that there was a German policy. He didn't know for sure what the German policy was. And, Cole takes issue with that greatly. And, oh, in part? What does he think Goebbels is referring to, if not a liquidation? In part, with not a liquidation in part. Coruscant is pulling an old exterminationist trick here, quoting a passage and then telling us what we've just read, hoping we won't notice the incongruity, and so on. And then, you know, he kind of overdoes these things, because he repeats what he's saying, and he repeats it another way, and he just, you know, Forison's description of the March 27th Goebbels diary entry reminds me of page 120 of dear old Mel Mermelstein's book, where it shows a picture of Crema 1 and writes in the caption, "Note the pipes and shower heads above." But see, now this sentence was not necessary. If he's going to say that what Goebbels said was clear and precise, that he knew what was going on and saying what it was, and Forison is trying to tell us that it shows that he wasn't sure, that he doesn't have to go on. Like I said, he just keeps trying to push and push and push on his points to destroy his opponent, and then he ends up bringing up something from Mel Mermelstein's book, which has nothing to do with it. But what it does is it connects Forison with that horrible Mel Mermelstein, that liar, in the reader's mind. So then what he's trying to do is say Forison is as bad a liar as Mel Mermelstein, which of course is not true at all, and is pretty horrible. And that's the kind of a tricky stuff that he does, Cole does. His last paragraph is, "The importance to me of this Goebbels diary passage is that for the first time we have a reliable piece of evidence which points to a plan of separation between those Jews fit for labor and the rest who have to be liquidated. Hated though some of us may, this fits the exterminationist model much better than it does the revisionist one. If revisionists wish to explain this passage some other way, they'll have to do better than the explanation offered by Forison. For myself, I can say that the meaning of this Goebbels diary passage in relation to events occurring at that time has yet to be adequately explained by any revisionist." Well, that's all he had to say, that he didn't think that Forison's explanation was adequate or was good enough. He didn't have to, but he wanted to take down Forison while he was doing it. But he calls this passage, this sentence by Goebbels, a reliable piece of evidence which points to a plan of separation. So it's kind of funny language, because it's only pointing to that there might have been a plan, pointing to a plan to separate the Jews fit for labor and the rest. And it's a reliable piece of evidence pointing to that. I don't know. It's not actually evidence of it, though. It's only evidence pointing to it. So it's kind of funny, you know, how that kind of thing is done. You know, this is a place I'm going to go over to my, I told people I was going to check my email to see if, there it is from RS. He's got some comments here, I think. All right. He says, he's given me some advice not to forget to speak further about the transit camps and what the issues are between David Cole, David Irving, and Mark Weber. And the revisionists, I would help those new people that have not heard these matters before. Thanks, as always, for your program. Well, you know, the weather has quieted down, so there's nobody would be telling me that, nobody would be telling me that that they can't hear me, so I don't need to hear that, but okay. Okay, Raymond, I am going to try to do that, because I'm going to close this email account now, because I don't think I'm going to get any emails I'm going to try to get into that, and I do have it. Maybe I should hurry on to that, because there's so many interesting things, though, to say about the way Cole is speaking in this, you know, because this is just real recent. And these days, I'm saying nothing new. Cole is saying he's not saying anything new these days. New to you, maybe, but not new. If you formed an opinion of me based only on partial samples of what I said or wrote in the 90s, that isn't my fault. So he's saying those who thought I was fully revisionist, that I thought I was a Holocaust denier, that I didn't believe in Jews being murdered in large numbers, and that's not my fault if you believe that, because I never said that. But you know what? That's the impression we got, because that's all we saw. Anything else that he said was not widely promulgated. You know, I mean, I didn't read a lot about him or anything. So it was mostly that video of his and his appearances on those television shows. And the rest of it, I wasn't that aware of what he was doing. So I suppose that's just the fault of what is publicized, you know. That's it. I wasn't close into the revisionist community or anything at all. So he says, which brings me to his second point. That was his first point, whatever it amounted to. I don't know. It was long. But his second point is the most intellectually weak and embarrassingly stupid position that anyone can take is, I'm so great that no one could possibly disagree with me. Therefore, if someone claims to disagree with me, it's not because they actually do. It's because they're lying, or they've been coerced, or threatened, or paid off. But it's simply not in the realm of possibility that someone might actually hold views that contradict mine. Well, there he goes again. He's trying to make a big thing out of the fact that people think that he is not, that as few people have said that they don't think he really disagrees with certain positions. They don't think that he really believes certain things he's saying. That's what I was just referring to. That's not a big deal. You know, he's seen in one way, and he's saying, well, you saw me wrong. I was never that way. And then he gets kind of angry about it, and he's going on and on about how people, it's not his fault if people saw him wrong. He goes on to say, I dealt with that shit constantly during my GOP days when leftists routinely accused me of having been paid off by the Koch brothers or Rupert Murdoch, because surely no one could actually be a conservative by sincere conviction. Well, he doesn't need to use that four-letter word, S-H-I-T, but he does, just like that above, calling Bradley an asshole and using the word dick for this radio program host. And then seeming to be overly agitated that people accuse him of anything. That, you know, he's overly sensitive is what he is, which you can understand where that comes from. And he's overly sensitive that anybody should question anything about him or say, well, you're not the way I thought you used to be. Oh, well, you know, who are you to think that? That's the way he's expressing himself. It's pretty crazy. So, you know, he goes to say in an elaborate way that if you want to dismiss his views on Treblinka by thinking that he doesn't really believe what he's saying, he says, please don't go down that road. It's not any of these things that other problems I have in my life, including his drinking and his grief, whatever, nor the JDL, that is making him take this position. he takes it because he believes it. He wants you to know that. And then he says, allow that I can actually form ideas and have opinions on my own. You see, again, taking offense that people would think that he's being forced into something, that he's not his own man, and he has his, you know, his opinions. And he follows that up by saying, Eric Hunt doesn't allow this. He claims to psychically know that David Irving and I are just pretending to disagree with him. Well, now he's going to start in on Eric Hunt. And he thinks he can really kick Eric Hunt around. I mean, that's his, you can see that's how he sees it. And Eric Hunt wrote a few comments at the end of this. In doing so, he said, he called Cole on this and said that this is not true, and he called Cole a liar. He said, you know, he never claimed that David Irving and he were just pretending to disagree with him, whether he was saying they were doing it, he knew it psychically or any other. See, he didn't say that he knew that, but he said something that led Cole to say that he's claiming that he psychically knows this, that they're just pretending. Cole goes on to say, it's actually, well, he just doesn't make much difference. It does, you know, it's quite astounding that Irving and I would collaborate on a plot like this. Well, see, here's where he's taking something, he's saying that it's false to begin with, and then he's going on and on with it and trying to, you know, building the whole thing up. And here's where he says, that it's ridiculous that I would pretend to disagree with Hunt, a man I have never met and whose name was unfamiliar to me until a few months ago when Smith pointed out, quote, he's the weasel elevator felon. Well, you know, when I read that, I thought, oh, that's not very, is that the way Bradley Smith puts, is that the way he talked to Clark? I keep calling him Clark. I was doing it all day. Cole. You know, because he said that, he's got it in quote marks, you think, well, Smith said that. I thought, well, maybe because they're, you know, friends and he might talk like that, kind of a loose way. But it turned out that Smith wrote a comment, too, after this article. And he said flat out that statement is false. And I believe Smith because he doesn't talk like that. And he that's not a very nice way to put it. I mean, it's not anything wrong with it, but to call him the weasel elevator felon is, you know, this is the kind of thing, though, that David Cole likes to do. This is the way he likes to humiliate and ridicule people. Any chance he gets, if he thinks that they're somebody, you know, that he doesn't like or doesn't like him. So in this case, in these cases here, these two people are calling Cole a liar, and it appears he's not above making things up like this. So it appears he's the liar, but he's calling everybody else a liar. It's really It's a sad thing, and I know this is extraneous stuff, but it's important in the whole thing about believing somebody, trusting somebody who's already shows himself that he's not above lying and making things up about people. Now, here is another part where he goes on to say, he says he's choosing his words very carefully here, not out of respect for Hunt, but out of respect for several mutual friends who have asked him to tread lightly where it comes to Hunt, I guess. So he says, so this is me treading lightly. Eric, your defense at your criminal trial was that you are mentally ill and delusional. He puts both those in quote marks. Please know I take schizophrenia very seriously. It is a tragic disease. It has affected several people close to me, blah, blah. I'm not mocking you. I wish you only the best. You know, here's what he takes these words that they applied to Eric at his criminal trial where he had to defend himself and stay out of prison. And the words used were mentally ill and delusional, which can mean a lot of things. And he turns it into schizophrenia. You see, the word schizophrenia was not used. Now, Eric took real exception to this, and it got him very angry. And I can understand why, you know, when you're called that. And so he wrote about this down below, too, in his comments. And he certainly he's calling on David Cole to debate him on a program, but David is not up for it. So this is really nasty, though. This just shows such a nasty character. And I don't think that Cole was as nasty before he disappeared. I think a lot of this, his character changed a lot. He was young still and a little bit idealistic. And then he just got cynical, and now he's, I just do attribute it to alcoholism, that he's had such a, not all alcoholics get mean like this, but, you know, everybody's different. The ones I've known are not mean, but, so now we get into the Corehair report and what actually did happen, and I will try to shed some light on that through this article here. This is what Cole says. It says the Corehair report, commissioned by Himmler, written by the top SS statistician for Himmler's eyes only, states that evacuations from the territory of the Reich, and including the Eastern territories and further, from October, I'm leaving out a few words that makes it very hard to follow. From October 1939 or later until December 31st, 1942. So this takes in a time of 3 years and 3 months. And during that time, the total number of Jews that were evacuated were 2,419,656, which they round off all the time to 2.4 million. So this is a three-year, three-month-long period of time. This is not all at once, that supposedly these Jews were evacuated east or somewhere, and we can't account for this many Jews. What happened to them? Well, truthfully, I think a lot of them just, as it's been said, stayed where they were, and or went back here or went somewhere else. They were moving around, but somehow they're supposed to have been under surveillance all the time, and they are under the control of the Gestapo and the security services of working in that area, and so we need to account for them all. And and of course Cole makes a big deal that in the Corehair report it states that those evacuees are no longer in ghettos and concentration camps. This is where it gets boring to most people, because they start talking about what was exactly said and what it means and what these words mean, because we're talking about it in English, and so does Cole, and it was all written in German, so we've got these German words and what do they mean, and you know, there's no final conclusion on this. It's all, well, you know, you have to consider yourself what it means. You have to put it all into context and say, by this word, the Germans meant this, or they meant that. And, of course, if you're an exterminationist, you think it means extermination. And if you're not, you don't think it does. So, you know, that's where it's stuck. And there's not good feeling in order to say, well, let's try to work this out. Because it really is two political positions. Maybe I shouldn't say that. Revisionists want to insist that there's no politics involved in what they're doing. And they try very hard for there not to be, and they not to think like that, think politically. But I think it's pretty hard to keep that out altogether, and generally you have a desire to find the Germans guilty of harming Jews, or a desire to find the Germans not guilty of harming Jews. Not that Jews weren't harmed, but it's just a matter of what the guilt is. At least I already covered some of that earlier for my own feelings. But Corhair states, and this is Cole's big thing, he states that, this is how he translates it, from 1937 to the beginning of 1943, the number of Jews in Europe has diminished by an estimated 4 million, partially due to, he's got two or three causes here. One, emigration, partially due to two, excess mortality, of the Jews, and three, partially due to evacuations, especially in a more strongly populated eastern territories. So three things, you know, emigration, that was all kind of earlier, because this starts in October 1939. So from then until the end of 42, you had a certain amount of immigration that would take care of some of these 4 million Jews. I guess we're just talking about 2.4 million. And then you have mortality, and then they call it excess mortality, because though more Jews were dying than were being born. And they didn't say that they're being killed, though. These are just old age and not the best treatment or something. Suicide. They think lots of Jews committed suicide. I don't know about that, but that's another reason. But then the one that sticks, that nobody can explain, is the evacuations. What kind of evacuations were they? Where were they evacuated to, etc.? And Cole argues that the evacuees were not in ghettos or camps, because he says, Corhair says, these evacuees are no longer in ghettos and concentration camps. That is interpreted differently, too. Did I mention Matonio and Graf? He said that he calls them the most extreme revisionists. Somewhere else he calls them hardcore revisionists, Carlo Matonio and Jürgen Graf. He's going after them now. He doesn't like them. And he says that they consider this Corhair report authentic. Even they do, so it must be authentic, because they're the most extreme. And so in this, he says that it makes a big deal about whether they are in ghettos or camps or not. And then that Europe had lost approximately 4 million Jews by 1943. That's where that 4 million comes in. And the causes for this loss, in the Corhair report, it just added up those who were evacuated that were $2.4 million. But the total loss of Jews to Europe, was 4 million. So at the end of the war, supposedly, wouldn't that be great if Europe? I have to say, you know, if Europe lost 4 million Jews at the end of the war and they never came back. Unfortunately, that's not what happened. Now let me find the next important part here. This is not too important. He says that Hunt accuses him of reading too much into code words, but he says, again, insultingly says, code words? Son, do you speak German? Of course, Hunt doesn't speak German, and neither does Cole, but he seems to have, making a good case that he can read German, and he's got a lot of familiarity with German. He's never spoken in German. I doubt he can. But he says, Abgang is not a code word, straightforward German word. It means gone, departed, dispatched. And then he's talking about some other words and what they mean. Not code words, Eric. Well, you know, he's again twisting around what Eric has said in his rebuttal, because he just wants to show that he has zero respect for Eric Hunt. And this is just a lot of repeat, repeat, repeat. He says, there is no evidence, Cole does, not 1 ounce of evidence that the nearly 2.5 million Jews counted as evacuees were simply transferred somewhere else. He is saying this is what Eric Hunt says, and this is what the other revisionists are trying to prove, and that he thinks they're not having any success, and says the revisionist challenge, then he says that now the revisionist challenge for those who won't accept the conclusion held by me, Irving and Weber, is to account for this massive number of Jews. Where were they sent? See, this is the crux of the matter. Cole, Irving, and Weber, and Cole says he's been saying that since before his disappearance. So I guess he's not following Irving. According to him, you know, this has been his belief all along. These three say, well, you know, according to the Corriere report, there's these 2.4 million Jews evacuated. They like to say they were sent to these camps and they were never heard from again. So they died in these camps. That was the end of the line for them. That's easy for them. They leave it at that. They don't care. They don't care just that they're saying that 2.5 million Jews were killed by the Germans. They don't care about that. They're happy to say that, or that suits them. All right. Those who are not willing to say that are looking for where they are, what happened to them. But it's not easy. I mean, how do you account for all these people? Because in that chaotic situation, and it's crazy there anyway in that part of the world. And they're all over the place, these Jews, and they're hiding too. And to say that you have to prove where everyone, what happened to every one of these Jews, is to me nobody should feel that they have to do that. You don't prove what happened to all those Germans. You don't prove what happened to all those Russians. They're gone. And so are these Jews. Well, these Jews weren't even gone, as we have all these examples where they show up later and people reported them dead. How many Jews were reported dead in concentration camps, you know, murdered, that later showed up. But mostly they don't want you to know they showed up. So the whole thing is kind of an impossible situation. And I say that then that that he who are we talking about? I guess the revisionists don't have to prove murder. Oh, I know. Yeah, Cole doesn't have to prove the murder facilities at Treblinka, Belzec, or Sobibor, but he says others have to prove where these Jews went. You see, the revisionists, he says, have to show where these Jews were sent, what happened to them. But when it comes to their idea that they were murdered at, say, Treblinka, Belzec, and Sobibor, the majority of them, they don't have to prove that these murder facilities existed there. And they don't have to prove that all these bodies were buried there. There's no evidence for either one. And they know that. So then they think they can put the burden on the revisionists that they have to account for what happened to these Jews. Well, they can't account for it, and they just go along with the Holocaust story that, oh, there were gas chambers in these facilities, in these what are called Action Reinhardt camps. But you know what? The Holocaust historiography says there were gas chambers, which is really makes them out to be foolish and makes it more difficult for them to show what really happened there, to insist that it was gas chambers that killed the Jews there. Whereas Irving at times has said that they were shot and thrown into pits and buried and then, I guess, dug up and cremated. He doesn't go into much detail about it, about how any of that was done. As far as I know, he doesn't think he has to. And somebody said recently that, while it was down in those comments, that David Cole never claimed that there were gas chambers at these camps or that the Jews were gassed. He only says that they were murdered there, exterminated there, whatever. And that might be true. So they don't want to get in. That leaves them off the hook in a sense. I don't know, Mark Weber doesn't say much at all. And when he starts being questioned, he says, he refers you to David Irving. He's going by David Irving. He has admitted that, Mark Weber, that he's going by what David Irving has done. And David Irving has, researched it well. David Irving can't come up with any sensible answers to back that up. So, they don't want to get into the gas chamber theory there because it's indefensible. But so that's where that's left. You see, it's not a fair game being played here. And then Cole goes into attacking Matonio and Graf some more, accuses them of playing games, and he says, look at this little game that Matonio and Graf play in Treblinka's transit camp or extermination camp, one of their books. And he talks about how they cite Christian Gerlach's information, and it turns out that, according to Cole, it kind of blows up in their face because they accept what Gerlach is saying, but then Gerlach doesn't do a very good job and leaves things hanging. And this causes a big failure of Matonio and Graf's position, and so on. And I can't really get into that. So. Then they quote Thomas Kuhn's translation from Inconvenient, or Cole does, Inconvenient History website about this why they failed so much here, because what they say happened, for example, I've just got some parts of it here, to say, Thomas Cuse writes, well, he's talking about how, yeah, the word, if this German word is translated as most extensive or as extremely extensive. You know, he's making a big deal about that, that Metonio and Graf used extremely extensive, and Thomas Gerlach and Thomas Cuse say most extensive. So here we have Thomas Cuse' translation being used, and he writes, most extensive were probably the, and Thomas Cuse is a partner with Metonio and Graf. Most extensive were probably the deportations of Polish Jews to Belarus. Also, in this case, it was the question of labor forces. The officers and enterprises of the SS and police in the so-called Russland Mitte, or I guess Middle Russia, roughly correspond to the eastern part of Belarus, were to be concentrated in two cities, Mogilev and Bobruisk. It might be Mogilev and Bobruisk. And so of what was mentioned there, he mentioned 960 Jewish men and youths were summoned by an appeal, and some of them arrested during riots in the Warsaw ghetto, were transported to Bobruisk in May 1942 for labor. And in another part, well, that's the only thing from Inconvenient, from, from Thomas Cuse. But then Cole goes on to say, several thousand Jews, and there's a few other examples in there. He says, several thousand Jews sent for labor. He says, they're only talking about a few thousand Jews for labor, not several hundred thousand employable and unemployable Jews sent for resettling. And these are the transports that Gerlach describes as the most extensive. So a few thousand is the most extensive. So he's putting down the idea that they come anywhere close to accounting for this 2.4 million with their few thousand here, or, you know, even 1,500 or even 10,000. I mean, it takes a lot of this to add up to even 100,000, you know, let alone all these millions. So he's just saying this is, you know, they're failing in this. They can't come up with it. Well, of course, they have come up with it. No, they've come up with quite a bit, but as he said here correctly, it's not adding up to anything like 2 million. But there's a lot that, since there's a lot that has been accounted for, there's a lot that would be unaccounted for. So at least they're working on it. But here's something I would like to read. It's he calls it another spectacular Metonio Graf fail. It's the Kuba Losa telegram, which he says they admit is authentic and reliable. But when they use it, they don't quote the whole thing. So he says, I'm going to quote the whole thing now. And he quotes it in English. And I first have to ask, whose translation is it? He doesn't say. He doesn't say who translated it. Did he translate it? And how good is the translation? Well, I can't judge that about the translation. But it says, talking about clashes in Belarusia or Belarus, has proved that... Okay, I got to read it. In all the clashes with the partisans in Belarus, it has proved that Jewry, both in the formerly Polish as well as formerly Soviet parts of the district general, is the main bearer of the partisan movement, together with the Polish resistance movement in the east and the Red Army from Moscow. Now, this is a telegram from two SS guys, officials or Gestapo or something, about the topic is combating partisans in action against Jews in the general Bezirk of Belarus. Okay, in their area, they're in charge of combating, and they're writing about how they're combating the partisans and their action against Jews in their area. And so then they go on to say, did I finish that? They're the main bearer of the partisan movement, together with the Polish resistance movement in the east and the Red Army from Moscow. In consequence, the treatment of Jewry in Belarus is a matter of political importance owing to the danger to the entire economy. It must therefore be solved in accordance with political considerations and not merely economic needs. That is, we need these workers, you know, and so we have to bring these workers in. They're saying that following exhaustive discussions with the SS Brigade Führer Zenner and the exceedingly capable leader of the SD, Obersturmbahn Führer Dr. Jurist Strauch, we have liquidated about 55,000 Jews in Belarusia in the past 10 weeks. It took them 10 weeks to liquidate 55,000. Supposedly in those camps, they liquidated, a half a million in 10 weeks. Or they liquidated the entire hundreds of thousands in 10 weeks. So but here, 55,000. In the area of Minsk County, Jewry has been completely eliminated without any danger to the manpower requirements. In the predominantly Polish area of Lida, 16,000 Jews were liquidated. In Slonim, 8,000, etc. Now, the thing is, what do they mean by liquidation? Do they mean they removed them? Did they mean they killed them? Well, they want you to, he wants, Cole thinks they killed them, and he wants you to think they killed them. But we've got this same problem with these words. But I don't care if they did. You see, when I'm reading this, and I know the difficulties that they had, and I know how much damage these Jews did, along with the partisans, in harming the German troops and harming the system there, I think they're such type of enemies, and under the conditions of wartime, that they could be eliminated, they could be killed, but I don't know that they were. I hope they were. It goes on. Owing to encroachment by the Army Rear Zone, which is a command, which has already been reported, there was interference with the preparations we had made for the liquidation of the Jews in Gleboki, Without contacting me, the Army Rear Zone Command liquidated 10,000 Jews, whose systematic elimination had in any case been planned by us. In the city of Minsk, about 10,000 Jews were liquidated on July 28th and 29th. Of these, 6,500 were Russian Jews, mainly old men, women, and children, and the rest Jews incapable of work who were sent to Minsk in November of last year. By order of the Führer, mainly from Vienna, Brünn, Bremen, and Berlin. The district of Slusk has also been relieved of several thousand Jews. The same applies to Novogrodek and Wileczka. Radical measures are planned for Baranovichi and Hansovichi. In Baranovichi, there are still another 10,000 Jews in the city itself, of whom 9,000 will be liquidated next month. Then it says, in the city of Minsk. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to go over my two-hour time. Those of you who are listening live, once again, it will be cut off in 5 minutes or four. And there won't be any music, so I'll wait and do a proper ending when I get finished. Sorry once again to my live listeners. So continuing with this, in the city of Minsk, about 2,600 Jews from Germany have remained. In addition, all of the 6,000 Russian Jews and Jewesses remained alive who were employed during the action by various units of the Wehrmacht. I'm going to skip a little part here. He says, the number of Jews used for work in all other areas will be reduced by the SD and myself to a maximum of 800 and if possible 500, so that when the remaining planned actionen have been completed, there will be 8,600 in Minsk and about 7,000 Jews in the 10 other districts, including the Jew-free Minsk district. There will then be no further danger that the partisans can still rely to any real extent on Jewry. Naturally, I and the SD would like it best if Jewry in the General Bazaar in Byelorussia was finally eliminated after their labor is no longer required by the Wehrmacht. For the time being, the essential requirements of the Wehrmacht, the main employer of Jewry, are being taken into consideration. In addition to this unambiguous attitude towards Jewry, the SD, and he's talking about this, he's saying they have an unambiguous attitude toward Jewry. I mean, not Cole, but these Germans. The SD in Byelorussia has the onerous task of continually transferring new transports of Jews from the Reich to their destination. They don't like it. They keep getting these Jews sent there, and they have to transfer them on. They call that an onerous task. This causes excessive strain on the physical and spiritual capacities of the personnel of the SD and withdraws them from duties within the area of Byelorussia itself. Well, now this is this makes me question here. That when they talk about liquidation, they talk about transferring these Jews, constantly transferring these Jews to their destination, and this causes having to just do this, you know, because I guess it's, you know, I mean, it's not fun to do that to people. It causes strain on the spiritual capacity of the German personnel, that, you know, I'm not in a position, not having the German either, not in a position, and I'm not such a revisionist at all that I figure out what should be meant by all that. But I think it's very interesting, and there's one more paragraph here. No, there's more than that. He says, I should therefore be grateful if the Reich's Commissar should see his way to stopping further deportations of Jews to Minsk, at least until the danger from the partisans has been finally overcome. I need 100% of the SD manpower against the partisans and the Polish resistance movement, which together occupy the entire strength of the not overwhelmingly strong SD units. See? So they don't want to get more Jews because they're having trouble getting rid of their Jews already. And I don't think it sounds like they're killing them. It sounds like they're having to move them on. And while they're around there, they're a danger because they've got all this. They're fighting all these partisans, and then having these Jews around makes it more difficult because Jews are sympathetic with partisans, and they think it's all very dangerous. And they don't have enough strength. They don't have enough people of their own to handle all this. And he says, after completion of the action against the Jews in Minsk, whatever that action is, Dr. Strauch reported to me this night with justified indignation that suddenly, without instructions from the Reichsfuhrer, and without, that would be, well, it didn't say Reichsfuhrer SS, so I don't know. And without notification of the general commissar, a transport of 1,000 Jews from Warsaw has arrived for the local Luftwaffe command. So all these Jews were being sent east, and they came to them, and then they had to do something with them. And they didn't like it. They said they were getting too many of them. They didn't want to see any more Jews. And then he said, I have this in large types. I think it's important. I beg the Reichskommissar, who was already warned by telegram, to prevent the dispatch of such transports in his capacity as supreme authority in Ostland. The Polish Jew, exactly like the Russian Jew, is an enemy of the German nation. Said that straight out there. These Polish and Russian Jews both are enemies of the German nation. So they see them as enemies. He represents a politically dangerous element, a danger which far exceeds his value as a skilled worker. Under no circumstances should the army of the Luftwaffe import Jews into an area under civil administration, either from the general government or from elsewhere, without the approval of the Reichskommissar, whoever that was, as this endangers the entire political task here and the security of the general Bezirk. That's what that area, that administration is called, obviously. And finally says, I am in full agreement with the commander of the SD in Belarusia that we should liquidate every transport of Jews not arranged or announced by us, announced to us by our superior officers to prevent further disturbances in Belarusia. Well, this last sentence does sound to me like when he says we should liquidate, he means we should kill them. Because he says he's in full agreement that if these Jewish transports are not arranged, properly, and we're not announced to us, they just come without them knowing that they're coming, and then they're forced to do something with them. And they should just be liquidated to prevent further disturbances in Belarusia. See, I don't know if they could mean that if they came and they weren't, they had not okayed it, or they had not been announced to them, and it was not in proper order that people were sending off their Jews to them, that that they could just quickly send them somewhere else. That sounds a little difficult. So David Cole thinks this is very convincing that they were killing Jews. And here's where I say, you know, if they're killing some of these Jews, I think if it's true, I don't mind if it's admitted, and I don't mind if I think that to try to say that the Germans never killed anybody and they never hurt anybody and they didn't do, you know, I think it's not necessary. It isn't necessary. Of course, most of the revisionists are willing to say that they did. Execute. I should be using the word execution. They did execute a lot of them. But just how many they executed is the question. And I don't know if a telegram like this, you know, how to take it exactly. But I'm not worried about it. I no longer think that I have to say, the Germans never did anything like that. There are people who want to say that. They were such fine, upstanding, noble people. When they did execute people, it was important. I think I've got this somewhere, still coming up. It was important that they do it in a way that they were aware that they were carrying out their duty to their fatherland and to their comrades and so on, and not in a hateful or vicious way. That's the way they tried to keep it. But He gives a quote from Himmler, which I'm sure we've all heard before, so I'm not going to even bother with that. Then he's talking more about Himmler and the Korher Report, and I don't have any of that bolded. I don't until we get down here. He's quoting from from David Irving now. Now he's quoting from David Irving saying, David Irving wrote in Hitler's War, at Minsk, the German Jews survived at first, but not for long. The Nazis liquidated 35,000 of the native Russian Jews at Minsk to make space for the newcomers who were housed in a separate ghetto, the Hamburg ghetto. And that he wrote this in Hitler's War whenever that book came out, fairly early. So he's saying that, and then Cole says in spite of the fact that Irving wrote that, he was still welcomed at IHR conferences and Zundel rallies all throughout the 90s. He wasn't called a sellout or a traitor. Now here's, I don't know who he's talking about, if he's talking about himself or Mark Weber being called a sellout or a traitor. And then he says, oh, sure, Forisan attacked him, but Forisan is a sick man. There he gets back onto this again. And says that what's important, what his point he wants to make is that the revisionist audience back in his day, he's such an old-timer, you know, was somewhat different from the audience of today. There is no insistence on what he calls Forisonian purity. He said you could be, you know, like Irving was, you could disagree, people could disagree with one another's conclusions, but still appreciate their skill and the work they did. Well, you know, Irving, there's a difference between real Holocaust revisionism and historical revisionism. And Germar Rudolph said when he was on trial, in Germany. That was when Irving was coming out with some pretty wild stuff, and he got really irritated Rudolph, and he made this statement that David Irving was not a revisionist and didn't know what he was talking about, and nobody should pay attention to him. And that's the first time I heard that, because I thought, oh, you know, David Irving was being talked about as a revisionist all the time by then. And I thought, oh, wow. And, you know, I went along with Rudolph because I thought he knows what he's talking about. And he's a very honest man. And Germar Rudolph had said the same thing about David Cole. He said he's not really a revisionist because he doesn't want to learn about all the parts of it and everything that, you know, that there is to know. He just wants to go after his own particular interests. Now, you know, there's an awful lot here. I can't do everything. I will say here that he says that the Forisans and the Grafs and the Matonios have taken over revisionism. And he decries that a self-described delusional like Hunt has become a respected authority. And then he goes on to Frederick Tobin and says that he was on some white supremacy podcast, which he makes fun of, makes up a funny name for it, and just nutty. And then says that Tobin recently lamented the new position taken by me, Weber, and Irving, and Cole disputes that. No, he hasn't been saying anything new. Well, it surprised everybody, but still, somehow nobody knew that he was saying these things back in the 90s. And he says, we didn't change. Weber and Irving didn't change. Revisionism did. Well, no revisionists think that Weber didn't change, that revisionism changed. That's not true. But this is the way that Cole talks. And then says what a shame it is. And then he says, all the nice people he's met on his Facebook page since. And then he attacks Eric Hunt again for the error that he had in his Treblinka video, which he didn't remove soon enough. And he makes out that that's he was knowingly misleading his viewers because of this Joint Distribution Committee mistake he made. And I will say that he is right in that Eric should have pulled back the release of that video as soon as he, because on the day of release, Guillermo Rudolph told him about it and corrected him. And but he let that go for a while because he admits, and this is one of his failings, he admits that, where is that? Yeah, he says he had put a misidentified placeholder into an early draft, then he forgot about it, and he was rushing to get the project out and running, and not running it by other people. And then he didn't change it. He left that version out because people were commenting on it. See, that's the mistakes that he's making. He needs to be a lot more cognizant of how bad errors are. Errors are very, very bad in historical revisionism and Holocaust revisionism. It's better to wait, not be in a hurry to produce something so that you can be the first one to put it out there. And he was kind of in a hurry because of those television programs. But see, he shouldn't have been. He should have been more concerned with getting everything just right. Because then now it's come back to haunt him, and David Cole constantly is using that against him. And he doesn't have a very good defense. I mean, he can defend himself all right, but because David Cole's making more out of it. But really, it does show a failing there. So, but then David Cole ends up, see, because he thinks he can really take on Eric Hunt now, and he says, he's quoting Thomas Wolfe saying, "You can't go home again." And then saying, "Indeed, you can't go home again." He's not able to go home again because revisionism, as he's implied, you know, is not the same as it was. So he ends by saying, "So here's where I exit the elevator that Eric Hunt is riding in. Given the choice, I'd rather take the stairs." How nasty. I mean, that's as nasty as it gets. Once again, bringing up the elevator and associating Eric Hunt with his elevator interaction with Elie Wiesel. Well, now, there's something I was going to talk about, what David Cole wrote in 1995 in response to Forison. And it's very long, but I just had some parts of it here. But if you can find it at www.nizkor.org /FTP. Oh, it's got a long thing, but it's David Cole versus Forison Struthoff. And they're talking about, this is very interesting, it's talking about his trip to Natzweiler Struthoff. And I would like to go into that too, but now I really don't have any time to do it. But you can go there and read about it. I just took out what I thought was the important part. I don't know if I should try to cover a little bit of it because you kind of have to tell the whole story. But this is where he accuses Forison of being dishonest in a whole number of ways. And there is one thing that he says that is, let's see if I can find it here, that is convincing, which I didn't know, naturally. And well, I can remember it. Here it is. It's where, you know, because, see, David Cole really knows how to fight back. He's quite the fighter, and he will resort to low levels of fighting. And he says that because Forrestan said that he came out with this, I've talked about this before, but, you know, Forrestan claims that he came out with the revelation that the Auschwitz I gas chamber was never really used, and it was a reconstruction of a morgue bomb shelter, a morgue and a bomb shelter, and that he tells how he did it, and he says that when his first story was that when he looked at it, and then he realized what was wrong, and he asked to see an administrator, and he was shown to one of the head people there at the Auschwitz memorial, and he told him that these crematoriums, that these cremation ovens, he called them the ovens, had never been used. And the guy said, "How do you know that?" And he said, "Because I ran my finger around the inside, and there was no soot on my finger." And so, you know, even if they hadn't been used for a long time, or even if they'd been kind of cleaned up, there would still be some soot. And but they were brand new, never used, so that's why there was no soot. And he wrote all about that. But then later, he changed oven to gas chamber, so that now he was saying that he had discovered that the gas chamber had never been used as a gas chamber. This is what Cole charges him with, and if it's true, which I guess these two things he wrote do that. It doesn't say anything really very good about Forrestan, because it shows that he wanted to be the one to reveal that the gas chamber wasn't real, when that's not what he actually did. But at the same time, it's not enough, you know. We all have our failings, and nobody's perfect, and I don't think it's enough to stress the way that Cole is doing, because Cole has probably done some of his own things along these lines, but I can't say. But that's the only thing that I found that seemed to have something to it. But the rest of the things he says, it appears to me that he's just trying to make a big thing out of a little thing. So before I say good night to you, listeners, there's something from Thomas Dalton that I want to read. I've got two things here from Thomas Dalton, but I'm looking to see if I can just read part of it. Oh, I'm back in Cole again. Okay, let's see here. Well, he's Thomas Dalton wrote in, I don't know how important this is now, because I forget what it is. So I guess I'll just stick with my opening about the Jews. You know, the Jews being the biggest problem that we have, and then we're going to be so worried about what happened to them, and which is what this what you know, that we have to defend ourselves from harming any Jews on purpose. You know, we can't have done it. Well, here's something that Thomas Dalton, he's one of my favorite revisionist writers, that he had a part of something he wrote it's current. It's the Jewish hand in the World Wars Part Two. So it's the Jewish involvement in World War Two at inconvenienthistory.com. And this quote is, he writes, according to Cecil, in 1996 on page 57, I don't know if Cecil would be the author of a book on history, I assume. And it's about Wilhelm II, and he quotes from here, Wilhelm II believed that Jews were perversely responsible for encouraging opposition to his rule. Wilhelm II was the Kaiser of Germany during World War I, and at the end of the war he was deposed from his throne by the communists, and he was they changed the monarchy into a republic, and he was exiled, or he went into exile, and he lived to be a ripe old age, I think he lived in England somewhere where he had relatives, or maybe it was like in the Netherlands or something, but I think he ended up in England. But in any case, Dalton goes on. In a letter to a friend, the Kaiser wrote, "The Hebrew race are my most inveterate enemies at home and abroad." Now, this would have been early, or, you know, like in, probably before World War I. "They remain what they are and always were, the forgers of lies and the masterminds governing unrest, revolution, upheaval by spreading infamy with the help of their poisoned, caustic, and satiric spirit." Oh, I know I started out by wanting to say that I thought that Cole had a very caustic, satiric spirit. And I didn't use the word poison, but it's getting to be kind of poison. So he has developed that Jewish trait that is so known amongst the Jews. And Wilhelm II is saying that they are they're his worst enemy. You know, they're inveterate enemies at home and abroad. And they try to help destroy his government. Then Townley, another author, wrote in 1922, relates a comment by Wilhelm II, that is, "The Jews are the curse of my country. They keep my people poor and in their clutches. In every small village in Germany sits a dirty Jew, like a spider drawing the people into the web of usury. He lends money to the small farmers on the security of their land, and so gradually acquires control of everything. The Jews are the parasites of my empire." Wow, Wilhelm II called them parasites, knew they were parasites. He adds that the Jewish question is one of his great problems, but one in which nothing can be done to cope with it. Just think. And that's what most people think. People who are aware of what the Jews are up to and what they're doing, but they feel that nothing can be done to cope with it because they recognize the power of the Jews. And it goes. Dalton goes on to say, in 1940, with Hitler moving to clean up Europe, he said this, Wilhelm II, who is no longer in power, said, "The Jews are being thrust out of the nefarious positions in all countries whom they have driven to hostility for centuries." That's in a book by Roll. Wilhelm II didn't come out, you know, big for Hitler, but he wasn't opposed to Hitler. It was known that he was in agreement that let Hitler take over because Hitler seemed to be ready and willing to do what needed to be done. And he, I cannot say what his position was all along. I'd have to look into it again. I read about it in the past, but I've forgotten. But anyway, this is what the last Kaiser of Germany thought about the Jews and their influence on Germany. And we see from this that nobody thought he would have loved to have done something, but he didn't think it could be, he could do it. But he thought that Hitler was the only one who was ever willing to do it. And then everyone turned against him, you know, and fought against him, or he would have done it. And yet we're supposed to now, well, of course, that's the result of Hitler's success, is that when the Jews won, they now have to make it out and make everybody fall into line that anything bad that happened to the Jews is a terrible, terrible crime, and whoever is responsible for it are terrible, terrible criminals. And I think this is just as important. I've said this in the past in different ways, but this is just as important as far as our revisionist work goes, as far as in changing the historiography. It's just as important to see the Jews as the enemy that they are as it is to try to prove that the Holocaust didn't take place. Because no Holocaust did take place, except it is true that the intention was to remove Jews, and could never be all Jews, but it was going to be by far the vast majority of Jews out of Europe, and as far out of Europe as possible. As if Europe was going to expand eastward, then it would, you know, that was the intention of the National Socialists. But this was the intention, and this was a Holocaust for Jews. The real Holocaust was Jews not being wanted, not being allowed anymore. That before, everybody, and since, everybody thinks nothing can be done about it. And that's where it stands today, ladies and gentlemen. I hope this program has been not too long and tedious. It is a little bit tedious going into this stuff. So, but I thank you all for listening. I am Carolyn Yeager, and this has been the Heretics Hour on August 18th, 2014. And so I am saying goodnight and see you again next week.